Hello, and thank you for listening to A Fine Mess, the Pop Dose podcast that uses one-on-one conversations with artists to delve into the creative process. I'm your host, Jeff Giles. Today, my guest is Fred Wilhelm, a Nashville songwriter and recording artist who's been responsible for some of my favorite music of the last 20 years, including the pair of albums he released while signed to my label, which is the tip-off that lets you know this episode is much more of a friendly conversation than your typical interview. Still, even though Fred and I have known one another for many years, there were a lot of questions I'd never asked him before this conversation, and he responded with the honesty and self-deprecating humor that helped set him apart as a songwriter in one of the most music-rich cities in America. So how does a Connecticut farm boy go from worshiping the Rolling Stones via transistor radio to sharing an NYU dorm floor with Rick Rubin, playing at CBGB's, and finally writing for artists such as Rascal Flatts, Laurie McKenna, and Faith Hill? And once you achieve your creative dreams, how do you balance them against reality? The answer is a fine mess.
All right, me too. So the first thing I wanted to ask you...
Yes.
And I can't believe I don't already know this about you, but was how old you were when you knew you wanted to make music.
Oh, man. You know, I don't think I had one of those epiphanal moments. I mean, like any kid, I dreamed about being a rock star. You know, I listened to records and I slept with headphones on and all those things that everybody did. I put a stack of LPs on when I went to bed. I was the only one in my family. I dug, even at an early age, my parents had a bunch of old radios in the basement, and I dug an AM radio. And I can still very much remember what it looked like and some of the songs from that time period when I must have been, I don't know, 7 or 6 or something like that. But so I was always kind of into music, but I never really thought of myself as, you know, trying to make a living at it. And then, like every musician, I came to think that it might be a good way for me to meet girls, because I saw that guys at camp and stuff like that that, you know, were no more, you know, athletic than I was, were getting girls. So I started playing guitar, and I was in a little band in high school, and all the time I was doing it just for fun. And then I played in this band, this was before the Historians, I played in this band called Newspeak in Rochester, New York, with my then college roommate Lloyd Palin. And his father is a jeweler who designs jewelry and makes his own. He's just this creative guy, and I lived there for the summer. And that was where I really started. We started writing my own songs more than. And I was never, even as a kid, I was never really good enough to play other people's songs. I always started making up my own songs. But he was a huge influence on me, because he was a guy who fed his family and had a nice life and did it through a creative endeavor of his own. And it really resonated with me, the idea that maybe it's possible. And then later on, I played in the Historians, and again, that was a band in New York that I played in. And again, it was fun, and, you know, I was like, well, I'm going to do this a couple years. And then, you know, I got out of college, and, you know, it was always one of those things where I never really said, like, I'm going to do this for a living. It's my, you know, calling. It was like, oh, I'm going to give this a whirl for a couple years. I'll see what happens. And, you know, then it was like, if I haven't made it by 30, I'll quit. And of course, you know, I haven't made it by 35. I made it, you know, and then at some point you just realize, well, this is what you do. And so it wasn't a big epiphany. It just sort of crept up on me. And now, you know, I'm sort of at that place where, like, I don't, you know, thankfully my wife says no plan B. But if I had a plan B, it would probably be like fry boy or waiter or something like that. So I'm grateful that I'm able to carve out some kind of a living.
I think a lot of us are drawn in by just, you know, seeing somebody on stage or on TV and thinking, hey, you know, that looks like the best job in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and then, but for me, it's been such a slow term, because, you know, you see people out there playing and you want to meet girls or whatever it is, and you know, right. And I love playing out and I love playing in a band. I miss that was a lot of fun. But through that, I kind of found out that really what I do, the thing I feel like I'm the best at, is writing, and actually a part I really, really enjoy. So it's been sort of my my career sort of evolved as other things sort of slipped away, and what was remained was like, oh yeah, this is the essence of what I do and what I really love and what I feel like I can be pretty good at.
Well, that's the other thing. You know, you get drawn in by that image, that romantic image of what it means to be a musician or I don't know, an actor or whatever. But then once you're engaged in a creative pursuit, I think a lot of the time it becomes a tool that helps you work through issues.
Oh, absolutely.
That you might not have even known.
I mean, I always say that. I think, you know, I think songwriters are probably a very inarticulate group of people, because, or at least initially they are. Because I know, you know, when I first started playing guitar, and like I said, I couldn't really play Beatles songs. They were too hard. But I used to make up songs in my bedroom, you know, with the door shut, because my sisters didn't want to hear me. And they talk about it still, about how I'd be in there for hours and be like, oh. But, and so I'd make up songs, and I'd ended up, you know, writing songs about things I didn't even know were on my mind. And I think it became very cathartic and therapeutic and all that sort of stuff. And even recently, you know, that song of mine about my parents that I wrote, you know, I don't think I would have ever had the courage or the will to tell them those things that I said in that song. And so I'm really grateful that I was able to find an outlet for it. So yeah, it's been great therapy.
You mentioned your parents, and I wanted to talk about your early years. You grew up on a farm.
Yeah. Yeah, I grew up on a small family farm in New England. My parents are old. My dad's going to be 92 this year. My mom is 87. And she's a Jewish refugee, and he is a Depression-era Yankee. And they are the hardest-working people I ever met in my life. And when I was a kid growing up, we were close to self-sufficient. We raised all our beef, pork, chicken, milk, eggs, rendered our own lard, churned our own butter, heated our house with wood, all that stuff. And I learned incredible amounts from them about what it takes to raise a family and about hard work. I mean, they can still, even in their 90s, my mom will work circles around a lot of people's.
But here's the thing about that. I think for a lot of people, telling your parents that you want to give something as unstable as music a shot is often kind of dicey. But when you're growing up in a family business, it seems like that might make things even more complicated.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I think my dad, you know, we grew up on the farm that my dad grew up on. It's been in the family. And I think, you know, it was very important to him that someone stays there. I think he would have liked it to have been me. And also just because of their age and their generation, I think, like, you know, pursuing the arts was not something that they embraced, you know, to put it, you know, they weren't a fan of that. In fact, even when I went to college, I mean, you know, they're a generation that even like a school teacher was something probably not a good job for a man. Man's got to bring home the bacon. So I went to business school at NYU. And started playing in bands in New York, and you know, really meeting the people I met there was another, you know, great crossroad in my life, and changed me to give me courage to pursue creative endeavors. And they might not have sent me there had they known, but but you know, my case, and I always tell this to other people younger people when they're talking about doing music and things like that you know, I made a living. You know, even if I was working a temp job or in a hospital, I had a bunch of different odd jobs I've done. But the price of independence is, you know, paying your own bills. So as long as I was paying my own bills, they couldn't really say too much except worry about me. And they did. And, you know, and even after I'd, you know, gotten older and been doing it so long, I think it wasn't really until, you know, actually, I think they still worry about me. I mean, I haven't really hit a huge lick. I just sort of carve out a living doing this. So. But it definitely changed when I started making, you know, enough money that I didn't need another job. And in a way, I think they're proud of me about it. I think they, you know, they take some satisfaction that I've beaten the odds.
Yeah, you definitely have. I just feel like it must have taken a lot of not only courage, but I know there are a number of your early songs that reflect a sort of ambivalence about the farm, about small town living, about,
yeah, you know,
staying home, you know, that kind of stuff.
It's true, but I, you know, it's so funny. I think you know, I think that's probably everyone's song when they're 18 and 20 years old.
Sure.
You know, at my stage in life, The Farm has much more appeal to me than it did back then. You know, now I have kids of my own, and I wish that I was, you know, feeding them the food that I grew myself. But at the time, you need to get out. You need to find your own path. And, you know, I don't know if you want to go into it, but you personally had no small part. You were a huge step in me finding my way. So I'm always grateful to you for that. For listeners, there was a time where, you know, coming from the background I did, I really did not have the courage to just quit my part-time day job ever. I always jumped from part-time day job to part-time day job. And there was a point where Jeff had a little money and liked my music, and he gave me an opportunity to work solely on music for a year, and really changed the course of my life. During that time, I got my first cut, I ended up landing a publishing deal, and I made a record that I'm still very proud of, and a lot of good things came from that. So I'm very indebted to you. Thank you.
Well, I'm indebted to you. I mean, I'm very proud of that record too. And I was thinking about that earlier today, and you and I have both read that Steve Allman book.
Yeah.
Rock and Roll Will Save Your Life.
That's great. And I've turned some friends onto it too.
And the kind of the undercurrent in that book is that no matter how much you might love a person's music, there's always going to be a disconnect between the artist and the fan. And I think that,
I guess that's true. Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, you find out Bruce Springsteen's been having an affair, and it's disheartening, you know.
Well, there's more than that. It's like, you know, I reached out to you when I did because your music had such a big impact on my life. But, you know, you are always going to be the one making the music, and I'm always going to be the one enjoying the music. Mm. And it was, you know, I can try to bridge that gap by helping you bring that music into the world.
Yeah.
And I think the impulse there was kind of what Steve Allman was getting at in his book by, you know, flying around the country and reaching out to these artists whose music he really loved.
Yeah.
It seemed like in a lot of cases they didn't know quite what to make of what their songs meant to him.
Yeah, you know, I'm always surprised, and you know, I'm not like a big celebrity. I'm always surprised when there's people that, you know, that reach out to me that way, and it doesn't happen a ton. There've been a couple of one guy, you know, I never met, tracked me down, had me come play at his wedding because there was one song of mine on one old record that was so important to him and his then fiance, and it was like, wow, you know. So yeah, I really really appreciate that. And one of the things that I've learned is, as a writer, is that the more personal and detailed it is about your specific life, the actual details that are only particular to you are what make it the most universal to everybody. Because everybody has the same, really, we like to think that we're all on these great unique journeys, and we are, but we all worry about losing our parents. We all have thoughts about our kids. A lot of the themes that I end up writing about, many of them are family oriented, are very, very universal, even when I tell the most intricate personal details of my story, you know.
You mentioned going to college.
Yeah.
And I wanted to talk about your time at NYU. I think you crossed paths with Rick Rubin for a minute, right?
Yeah, Rick Rubin was, I went to NYU, and there were a lot of, you know, a lot of very successful people were there at the same time. Rick Rubin was, I was his RA. He was in my dorm room, in my dorm floor at Weinstein. You know, the Beastie Boys were there. Run DMC was there. LL Cool J. These guys would come by and tag in on the elevator with markers. Adam Sandler was over in one of the other dorms. There's a bunch of, Bridget Fonda was, I mean, there's just, that's one of the great things about going to school at NYU is that, you know, the education was fine, but really it's about the people you meet and the peers you make, and you know, the creative people. And I'm not saying any of those people were close friends of mine, but I made some close friends with some very talented and creative filmmakers and musicians at that time, and they really had an impact on my life.
It seems like being in the middle of all that music in New York in the 80s must have had a tremendous impact on your songwriting too.
Yeah, well, you know, just like, I mean, coming from a small farm town, it's just like your horizon just keeps getting pushed back. And then after a while, the realms of like, maybe I could really do this.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think I went to New York thinking I would do anything but go to school and get a business job somewhere. You know, and then you start to dawn on you like, man, I'm playing CBGB's Friday night and I'm opening for the Psychedelic Furs or whatever.
Uh-huh.
You know, I could, in a couple of years, maybe someone will be opening for me at CBGB's, you know? So it did have a huge impact. And also, you know, there's just so much great music to hear and see, and everyone was open to it. And, you know, when you play in a college, you automatically have an audience to start with because all the people in that, your friends and their friends want to come support you, and then it kind of, you know, mushrooms.
Right, right. But
I think snowball is the word I meant. Not mushrooms.
Mushroom, snowball, whatever. A mushroom in a snowball.
Yeah. Mushroom ball.
There's something about this era, though. I want to talk about working within limitations, learning to work within limitations, and the fact that I think having limits is often tremendously helpful. I mean,
yeah, I mean, that's an expression I'm sure you've heard. Limitations dictate style.
And there's also the tyranny of choice.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. And it's a blessing and a curse. I mean, here in Nashville, like, I mean, as someone who's lived in New York a good long time and spent a lot of time in LA, I'm telling you, the best musicians in the world are in Nashville, Tennessee. And probably the best songwriters in the world are here. I mean, it is, the talent level is unbelievable. And there's some people that are so talented that it is a hindrance. They can do everything, so they don't know what to do.
Right.
You know, or they don't have anything that is uniquely theirs.
Right.
And someone like me, you know, I kind of, you know, as I tell people, I can kind of play and I can almost sing, but it kind of keeps me within a certain framework of the kind of music I can do. But that's one of the liberating things about writing as opposed to performing. Is that, you know, I can write with a great singer, and if I can dream it, she can sing it, and it is fun to have those boundaries stretched out like that.
You had to go through a process to figure out what those limits that you have were, though. I mean, I know that, you know, when I was writing, when I was recording, often stuff would end up sounding very different after it was written and recorded than it did in my head, and...
Yeah. I mean, I still think I have under the illusion that I'm a better singer than I am.
You are a better singer than you think you are.
I'm always disheartened when I hear myself played back somewhere later. But in my head, it always sounds great. And I just, you know, at this point, I just go for it. Like, this is what I do. And I just make up for it by writing better songs and being more sincere about it than the other guy. That's what I try and do. But there, you know, I think, you know, I don't know, like, it's really, I never really felt that limited. Like, I know, I just find a way to make stuff work somehow. Like, lots of times, even now, like, I'm working on a track here today, and it's kind of a mess. Like, I can't, something's missing. But I'll just keep noodling around and playing something, and eventually the key that pulls it together and makes it work will reveal itself, and then it's like, oh, it seems like it was a great idea all along, you know?
Well, you know, I don't think of you as being limited.
Well, that's fine. Well, I have my limits, but I live well within them, so
I'm just always fascinated by the journey that every artist has to take to get from who they think they are in their head and who they hear in their head to kind of knowing who they are, who they really are as an artist. And that made me think of you coming up in New York in an era when every track counted. And you know, if you go into the studio, every minute counts.
I mean, we were, you know, I'll never forget, like, it's so funny. Like, the publisher I work for now, I have a studio I go to every day I work in.
Yeah.
But the first, you know, just to go to a rehearsal space.
Crazy.
Like, oh, my gosh.
Yeah, you made
it. Check this out. And these rooms are soundproof. It's not, you know, Frida's basement, you know. So each step has been amazing like that. But, you know, the other thing was, I think for me, part of it was in terms of realizing what it is I do. You know, I came up during a time when there were a lot of bands that were that were cool to like that I may have acted like I liked, but I really didn't like that much. You know, like you know, the Meat Puppets or Husker Du or whatever. Some of these really, and not to take away from what they do, it's just not my thing. But they were very popular and they had an influence on our band at the time. And really, like, as I got older and started doing more and more of my thing, like, you know, the Cheap Trick lover reveals itself. I mean, that's the, you know, I've given the choice between Husker Du and the Knack. I'm turning towards the Knack. I'm sorry. Right. I just like that stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting to me how quickly even your vocal style refined itself. I mean, I heard the Astorians record, and in those days, you were trying to be a much louder singer.
Yeah.
And even by the time you got to do the first Rails record, you were singing much more melodically.
Yeah, well, I mean, because I wanted to sing melodies. I don't know. I love melodies, you know. And that's what, like I said, when I'm, there's some writers I write with that are great singers, and, you know, we can come up with great melodies and hear them singing. It is amazing. But I also, you know, I've dabbled some, as you know, a little bit in rap because yep. I don't feel like I'm a great singer, and I love the freedom of, you know, I'm a real rhyme whore. Like, I'll stuff as many rhymes as I can, and I really, you know, I feel like I'm pretty good at it. Like, when I'm writing with people, like, I mean, I just think in rhymes. I've been doing it so long, you know, with the Gladwell says I need the, was it 10,000 hours? I mean, I put in 50,000 hours doing this now.
Yeah.
So I really, I love rhymes. And I love to try and make tight little rappy verses and things because it's really fun. It's like a puzzle.
Well, I think you do a pretty fine job of that when you're singing too, but I understand what you're talking about with the...
Yeah, and you know, I kind of, you know, I still do it kind of sing-songy style. It's fun.
What, clearly, you know, even as self-deprecating as you want to get, you have to know that your lyrics set you apart. And I wonder what that journey was for you. I mean, why are you a wordsmith?
You know, I wish I could have, I mean, my, I come from, there's a lot of English teachers in my family, a lot of books in my family. I'm like a you know, Stephen King said, you need to read to write. And I'm a believer in that. Like, and I just like words. I mean, I remember even in high school, I was writing stuff and my English teacher was like, you know, you should really pursue writing. I just have always liked words. And, you know, I had this kid, Oscar, who's 4, and he's got the hugest vocabulary. I mean, I don't know. I think it's just in us. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's just there. We talk a lot, and I think in words, and, you know, I'm not some abstract visual artist or anything like that. I think my brain just works on words. But it has been a gift, and I think, like, the more I write and the longer I do it, I feel like, you know, lyrically is probably the greatest strength I have. I can do a lot of stuff. I'm getting better at a lot of stuff, but lyrically I feel like I'm pretty good at that sometimes.
Do your kids understand what you do yet?
Oscar does, I think. He likes to, he tells me, I like every song you write, Daddy. you know, and he makes up songs. I think they kind of do. You know, Augie's not even quite 2 yet, so I don't think he knows what I do, but he does know my name, so I'm grateful.
I think my kids still think that I talk to people and I type.
That's, you know, that's probably what my kids think too, Dad. Like, you know, noodles around a guitar and plays on the computer, and I don't know.
What was the first song you wrote that you were truly happy with? Do you remember?
Wow. You know, I don't know. I mean, the thing is, there's lots of songs that I loved. I mean, to do this job, any creative job, you probably the same. Like, anytime I do anything, I think I'm the greatest writer ever. You know, the last song I wrote is always like, oh my God, I'm Dylan.
Yeah.
You know, and then like 2 days later, it's like,
it's old.
Dylan Light.
Yeah. No,
it's not so much. And so even, you know, going back to early songs, like they're ones that I really loved and was really proud of and played every night, you know, for those 2 years. And looking back now, I'm not so proud of, you know. So I don't know. I will say, like, that one song I wrote with my parents on that record that we made still holds up. I still play that a lot, and it, you know, it always hits people. So that's probably one of the ones I'm the most proud of, but there's been a bunch of them.
I hope, you know? So. I was going to say, that's as far back as you'll go. Is you wrote that in like 98, 99.
Yeah. You know, I definitely some of the ones I'm Wonderful, I'm really proud of.
Good.
Yeah, you know, it's a shame too, because some of that stuff I feel like suffered from fidelity. Like, we just didn't have the tools to even to do what we... I mean, we made a cool sounding thing, but it was only released on cassette, and, you know, I wish I could take it now and jazz it up and things like that.
Cassette is the hip way to release things now.
Is it?
Yeah.
Well, I guess I was ahead of my time.
You got to go back to Brooklyn. You'll
fit right in. Get out of the PV board and mix another record.
I guess next, you know, we've talked about your time in New York, and we've kind of brushed up on the rails. We'll get further into those songs in a little bit. But you made a big move in the early 90s.
I packed up and moved to Nashville, and that was kind of one of the things we're talking about. As you kind of your path reveals itself, I just sort of came to the conclusion that, you know, as I said, my real skills were as a writer, and I love playing and I love singing, and I still gig out, and I'm grateful people come out and see me and they applaud, and it makes me feel great, and I need it. But my biggest talent is as a writer, and I love this job. Like, I can't tell you how much I love my job. I mean, I can't wait to do it. I get up every day and do it, and since I've been making a living as a professional writer, I mean, I've written well over 100 songs a year for the last 13 years.
Wow.
You know, and some of them are good. Some I had to write to get to the one behind it, you know?
Right. Yeah. Do you believe in that?
Yeah.
Like the whole flushing the pipes school of thought?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I really do. I feel like, and sometimes, you know, like, yeah, I absolutely believe in that. Sometimes you can get, like, if I go away to write, and I'm not, you know, I'm not here, you know, making lunches or whatever in the morning. If I go away and I wake up thinking about songs and I can write a couple in a day, and then you really, it just starts opening up because nothing's interfering in the pipeline, and it's great. I do believe in that. And I believe, like, you know, like anything, you just need to be good at something, you need to do it a lot, you know? The Beatles had to go play those thousands of gigs in Germany. You know?
Yeah.
You need to do it a lot to get good at it.
There's a tension, though, in I think, well, maybe you have found a way to make it work. I know that for me, I do a lot of stuff for hire, and I feel like I'm always at risk of, I don't know, pissing away the muse, or, you know, kind of alienating whatever gift or whatever craft I have.
You know, I think about that from time to time, but I'm lucky, and I don't think every writer is like me, but I'm lucky in that, you know, sometimes it's a huge creative outlet and endeavor and something very cathartic and personal, and I'm lucky that there's some people I write with and some, you know, quirky artists I write with that want to go there with me, and I love that. But some days it's just a puzzle to me. It's like sitting down to do a Sudoku. You know, I'm standing here looking at a box of Wheat Thins across from me. I'm like, if I had to write a song called Wheat Thins now, I could probably think long enough about it and find some angle on it and do it. I have the skills. And some days it's just a puzzle, but I like puzzles. Right. You know, it's fun to sit and do that. And then other days it's like, you know, this is really heavy on my heart and I've got to get something out, and you know, things just start forming, and you let them come out. You know, I'm not one of these guys that feels like you need to suffer for your art. I mean, some people just are, you know, it's your outlook. It's what you bring to the job. You know, and growing up as I did, you know, I mean, I know what real work is like.
Right.
I mean, I was picking tobacco 14 and 15, and this is not real work. This is like getting paid to play games with your friends. Mm-hmm. You know, so I love my job, and like I said, you know, there's occasional times where it's like, man, it's not easy, occasionally, but you know, that's why it's a job. And then other times it's like the most liberating, enchanting thing ever, you know. So
there's a little bit of weirdness, though. I mean, when you have something like this, some outlet, some creative outlet that you really desperately need to pursue, and then, you know, you work toward the ability to pay your bills by pursuing this creative outlet, then you reach this weird point where your love is your job, and you have to strike that balance always between what's good for your career and what's good for your art. And sometimes it's hard to realize, it's hard to see
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I mean, but I don't know. I mean, for me, you know, I've been trying to sell out for years. It's hard. Like, I wish I could, you know, just crank out some really commercial stuff that would take away my worries.
Right.
But I just sort of do what I do, and you know, there's times when what I do sort of crosses paths with commerciality, and I'm very grateful when that happens.
Right.
There's other times when it kind of crosses paths with, you know, something meaningful and personal to some people, and I'm grateful for that. And you know, you're always trying to balance art and commerce somehow, but I don't know how, and I don't sit here and like bemoan it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not like, you know, when I feel like writing something really personal and meaningful, I'll do it. And the other days, I'm not going to sit here and like stare at my navel or, you know, break up with my wife or something horrible to cause that to happen. My life is good. I'm happy to be working. I like writing music. I like singing songs.
I think another thing, another sort of tricky thing that can trip people up is that you begin, I think a lot of us begin writing because we want to be understood.
Yeah. And well, a lot, you know, that's why we fall in love and everything. I mean, that's like the quest of life.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But creating to those ends is a little weird, because when your stuff finally gets out there in the world and you end up getting feedback from other people, it can throw you off your axis a little bit maybe even inadvertently affect what you create.
Well, yeah, no, I think that's true. I mean,
you start wondering what people want from you.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, I work for a publisher, and I need to have so many songs recorded to keep my job.
Yeah.
So I want to write some songs that someone's going to like and record.
Yeah.
You know, having said that, I realize that, like, you know, I can only do what I do and hope it coincides. There's guys who wake up and grew up listening to music that I didn't listen to, and to them, all they want to do is write, you know, whatever, Craig Morgan song or something like that. That's not my skill.
Yeah.
That's not my talent. But, you know, I hope I feel like I'm letting you down a little bit, because I don't want, you know, I'm not like the tortured artist.
I don't want you to be the tortured artist, believe me.
You know, I'm really part of my, what has allowed me to survive in this business is that I'm an optimist.
Yeah.
You know, I'll I've tried to always keep the perspective that for me, the process is the reward. I get to do it, you know?
Yeah.
I'd like to make $1 million, I'd like to do this, but I get to do it, you know? I mean, I don't know anybody else in my hometown that gets to do what they want every day.
It's valuable, and I think that's a beautiful perspective, and believe me, I'm not looking for a tortured artist.
Well, I hope your readers won't be disappointed or like think, oh, for... But anyway, that's where I'm at.
I think all of this is really instructive for anybody who's looking for balance between real life and creative pursuits, and I think that's a lot.
Yeah,
of us.
And it can, you know, it can be done. And like I said, I'm it's still even though I write a lot and sometimes it's a puzzle, it's still my greatest love, my first love, and it's a huge emotional and it's a support network for me. You know, part of the process of my job, which is so great, is that every day I meet with, you know, if I'm co-writing, I get together with somebody, and within minutes we are talking about the most intimate personal details of our lives. You know, I'm like, I go see a shrink, or I am the shrink every day to somebody, and it's great. You know, it's really informative, and you know, it's great.
It seems like on the best days it could be a really remarkable, wonderful process. I've talked to some guys who get a little bitter about it after a while, and they feel like they're being brought in to teach somebody else how to write.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's true. You know, there's lots of times where, you know, if you're writing with an artist who's got a record deal, you may end up carrying some of the load. But, you know, again... Like I like the process. I like the jobs. You know, if I got to sit here and write a song by myself while you're in the room, I like writing songs by myself. You know, it's not the worst thing in the world. You know, I mean, there's some, I've had some times where it's very, very difficult, where people, you know, are critical but don't want to give you any input and things like that, and that can be difficult. Yeah. But for the most part, it's not so bad. And you know, if it's really bad, there's ways to get out of it. You know, just crank something out and get out the door so you can go do what you want.
I think what's beneficial here is that you took a long road. I mean, you were in Nashville for a while before you started getting cuts, and you were working for a long time before you even went to Nashville. So maybe it goes back to that working within limitations thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, yeah. And like my background, like I'm just my publisher said, was talking about me to my plugger, and they said, if Fred is a blue collar writer, like he's meat and potatoes, that's what he called me. And it kind of is, like I'm very workmanlike about my job. I mean, not that doesn't mean I won't stay up till one tonight working on something, but you know, I get up a cup of coffee, I go to work. I mean, one of the lessons I learned when I moved to Nashville was I went to see, I think it was Tony Arata or someone like that at the Bluebird, and he said, show me a writer who writes only when he's inspired, and I'll show you a waiter.
Yep. And and probably six waiters at the Bluebird hung their heads.
Yeah. You know, and it stuck with me. I'm like, I have a job to do.
Yeah.
And I take it, you know, luckily I enjoy it a lot, but I take it very seriously. I work at it daily. You know, I write every day.
You say workmanlike, and I understand what you're saying, but I think that your grasp of the craft is a little more. You have an individual style. When I think of workmanlike, I think of a guy like John Hyatt, who maybe it's bad to call him out like this, but I was talking to a songwriter earlier this year, and he name checked Hyatt as a guy who, when you hear his stuff on the radio, you know that, you know, Hyatt is the type of guy that wakes up at 9 o'clock and writes a song by lunch, and he does that 5 days a week.
Really?
That's workmanlike to me. Yeah, well, I just think a lot of Hyatt stuff over the last, I don't know, decade or so sounds kind of samey. He sounds like a guy who, you know, if there's an assembly line, he might be at it. He might be
Well, you know, I think
your songs are not widgets.
Well, you know, I that's kind of you to say. I think, you know, there are widgets in the on the conveyor belt. You know, the thing, I create a lot of widgets.
Right.
But the ones that I choose to put out under my name are the ones that are special to me. You know, like if I'm writing 100 songs a year, there's a bunch of Chryslers in but you know, doing that every once in a while, I'm like, whoa, here's a Lamborghini that showed up. I'm going to save that for myself.
Right.
You know?
Right. How, this question does not have an easy answer, but how did you work your way into the industry during those early years?
Here in Nashville?
Yeah. I mean, you show up off the turnip truck with a knapsack on your back.
Well, I mean, Nashville's a co-writing town,
yeah.
And you got to try and co-write. And some very successful writers told me, like, find your peers, people that you think are good, that are trying to break in, and your class will rise. And that kind of happened. You know, I wrote with some people. Some people had deals, publishing deals that I didn't have, but I was good enough that it wasn't a waste of their time to write with me. And, you know, eventually something happened. I think I had this one song that I wrote with Kevin Fisher. While I was making that record with you, and I brought it to a publisher, and she's like, you know, if I get this cut, will you give us part of the publishing? And I said, sure. And the band cut it. The band turned out to be Rascal Flatts. And then, you know, then you have a cut on a pretty good record, and all of a sudden people are more interested in taking a meeting with you.
It's a great story.
It's a great story. And it's not over.
It's not over.
I have high expectations for 2013. Things are going. It's a great story.
Let's talk about some of your songs.
Okay.
We'll start off by going back to the Naked Baby Pictures. A couple of cuts from Wonderful.
Yeah.
The first one that I want to talk about, I think you could probably guess, because it was
Far and Wide.
Far and Wide. First one of your songs I heard, and I ended up covering it myself with your help.
Yeah, that song, you know, I'm in a duo with my friend Richard Pierce.
Yeah.
We're both doing day jobs at a temp agency. you know, and we're young and in New York and striving for something. And, you know, to me, that I write a lot about things being elusive. Like, I sort of feel to me that a lot of things, I have great aspirations, and I always feel like so many things are just barely out of reach. You know, like my fingers are grazing them. And that some of that is what that song is about longing for something and always being just a little bit shy of it.
Another song from the record that I wanted to talk about is one that goes back to what we were saying earlier about your wordsmithery, because it has, this may be a song you don't even want to think about at this point, but it's got a great couple lines. She doesn't set her flowers in a vase, she sticks them in an old mason jar, and our bedroom's a mess, but I couldn't care less. She says no guests allowed in our boudoir. That's great.
Well, thank you. Well, you know, that was, yeah, I was seeing somebody.
Yeah.
And, you know, just, you know, there was something, I think, at the time, a lot of those songs that I write in the time were very immediate. You know what I mean? Like, I have a tendency sometimes to process too much and think about things. And some of those songs, like Rosemary, you know, just got, you know, those words fell out because that melody asked for them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was some of those ones were very immediate, but it was, you know, I they just fell out. But even then, you can see, like, when you read it back to me, our bedroom's a mess, but I couldn't care less. There's no guests. I still got three rhymes in. You know, like my mind was just working in that way.
Yeah.
That I hear rhymes fall into places.
Yeah. So those two songs, you're talking about music being immediate at this point. Those two songs, how much did you sweat over them?
You know, they're... You know, it's a different process. I probably sweated over them, far and wide, not so much. Resume, I probably sweated over some. You know, because when you're only writing, you know, 20 songs a year, 25 songs a year, something like that, you're not writing every day. You're just writing in between when you get home from work or in between gigs or in the van or whatever. You have a lot of time to think about the songs you're working on. So you're singing them in the shower and things like that. And the more you sing them in your head as you're going about, you know, whatever you're doing, riding the subway, you tweak little things, even if it's just phrasing and things like that. And I know, you know, as a performing artist, that's something I want to do with the songs. And a lot of the people that I write with that are performing artists, like, will write the song and, you know, really is probably still going to go through the artist's mind tumbler for another month or so of him walking around singing it and making little phrasing changes and things until it's just the way they want. But Rosemary, I probably sweated a little bit more, but, you know, none of them were like, you know, none of it's grueling work, you know?
And then when it comes to recording, I know at this point you were using fairly primitive gear.
Yeah, I had a half inch, I think, I had a half inch 8-track that did I have that then? Yeah, I think so. That I had, and an old PV board, and, you know, we had no effects. I mean, the keyboard part was literally played on my friend, my partner, Richard Pierce's. He had a son at the time, and he had a little toy.
Ha!
Toy Casio keyboard. I mean, it was about the length of your forearm. And we put a 57 up to the little speaker and use that for the like the little xylophone parts on Rosemary or from that. And actually, it's, you know, it's all a Roland drum machine, no live drums, but it sounds pretty good. I really, we had good ideas, even if they weren't great. The sonic quality wasn't great. The parts are good. The ideas were great. Were good. They fit together.
But does all that stuff affect the way you write the songs, knowing what you are and are not capable of getting down on tape?
No, I don't. I mean, no.
Okay.
It really didn't. Like, I mean, I had this incredible naivete that I just sort of, you know, I picture, you know, if we wanted to make a Phil Spector record in that Brooklyn apartment, we could do it. You know, I don't really think about those kind of limitations, you know. About my limitations, whether I'm going to hit that note, maybe, things like that. But limitations about the technical stuff, we'll figure it out.
She gives me a grin and said, let's get a view.
Let's move on to the second record.
Happy Summer?
Happy Summer, 1994.
Okay.
The first song I wanted to talk about was Life of Crime.
Oh, gosh, man, I got to think about some of these songs. The one thing I'll say about the song was great was, like, Richard programmed a drum. Like, I'd written it, and Richard started playing a drum pattern to it thing he made up that totally changed the mood of that song. It has a very different feel than when I just played it on a acoustic guitar. God, I gotta, can you remind me about it? I mean, I can hear it in my head, but I gotta remember the words just to remember what it's a long time ago.
It's told from the standpoint of a guy who had a bunch of dreams. You know, I saw myself in Denver. I saw myself in...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and you're talking about being...
Yeah, well, that's like, you know, again, this elusive thing. You know, I'm striving. I want to be a musician.
Right.
And I see a lot of lonely people and a lot of people striving that never get there. And it's scary. And that's, you know, the life of crime in that song is like, you know, it seems criminal to try and do something that isn't just, you know, the thing your parents wanted you to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's hard. It's hard to see, to know that that's a possibility. And I think, you know, there's a lot of people that do great work that never receive recognition or any financial thing or even the respect of their peers or anything like that. And it's still a noble ambition, you know, to me. I remember one time I was really depressed and worried and I couldn't get anything going and like, do I need to go back to school or what am I going to do? And, you know, of course, my sister told me, of course, I can't think of her name, the poet. You know, the hope is a thing with wings.
I don't know who wrote that line. I'm embarrassed to say that.
Oh, come on. She wrote, I got on the shelf. You know, who's one of the greatest poets?
You say hope, and I think of David Lee Roth saying that hope is the name of a stripper in Albuquerque.
The hardest part of living.
I love all that stuff, and I love the fact that in the last verse of the song, you talk about being able to understand being distant from your father when you were young.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, these are all things when you're trying to be a creative endeavor, like, you, part of being honest is can distance you from people.
The second song I wanted to talk about from that record is one that I didn't really appreciate at the time, but now I can hear it for the really heartbreaking ballad that it is, which is Holding On Again.
Yeah. That, you know, that one, I remember, I recorded that in Nashville. I was living in an attic apartment, and I was trying to sing that opening line, "Here I am."
Mm-hmm.
And my neighbors downstairs, I mean, I must have sung it like 400 times trying to get it so it would sound good. And they were like, they were next day, were just like, "Fred, here I am. Here I am. Holding on again. Something is gone. You know, it's so funny, like, talking to you about it, it really seems like a lot of these themes keep showing up again. Things you're striving for, things you know, you want, and that, and then there's things that you hang on to too long. You know, it's about clinging to things that aren't there anymore.
It's hard to write a song about letting go without writing a song that's also about being bitter, and this song, I think, walks that line pretty successfully. It's open, as you say. You know, you're always striving to be more sincere. It's very sincere.
Thank you. Talking to you makes me want to go listen to that record again. It's been so long.
Yeah. It's got those lines about believing in fairy tales, and then there's that killer line at the end where you say, "Just because I'm in love, that doesn't mean love wins."
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's true. I don't know what to say. You know, anybody who's had their heart broken, and yes. I imagine we all have. Like, you just things. You know, things are what they are, and it's constantly a puzzle to me because I want things to make sense. I want good to be rewarded and hard work to be rewarded and all these things that these ideals that I have, you know, that were taught to me by my hardworking parents. And then, I mean, there's just it's just not so. I mean, I like to think there's a correlation, but there's a lot of things that just don't work out the way they're supposed to. And I don't know why. And I always had this sort of like, you know, there but for the grace of God, like, why am I lucky? And I'm an incredibly lucky person. I mean, I've done every stupid thing that everybody who had something bad happen to them did, you know?
This brings us to your most recent solo record.
Yeah, A Midlife.
A Midlife.
Yeah, the one performing songwriter called The Midlife Crisis set to music.
Yeah. You talk about you know, feeling good. A lot of these songs were written during a time when you were not.
Yeah, no, that was a big. I mean, that was really a turning point in my life, making that record, because that was while I was trying to get my start here in Nashville and trying to make a living doing this. And again, you know, at this point, I'm not a kid anymore. I'm in my 30s, and I'm still, you know, living on ramen and mac and cheese is, it's what everybody does when you're at 20, and it might be noble when you're 25. You know, there's some point where it's like, you know, am I a loser?
It's irresponsible.
Yeah, you know, like at some point it's like, if music doesn't happen and I'm still doing this, am I a loser? You know, I don't want to be alone and eating ramen and you know, buying my clothes at Goodwill and doing a crappy day job, you know, in another 5 years or another 10 years, because that's a pretty bleak proposition. So a lot of this was kind of my midlife crisis about, you know, what am I going to do? I'm here so far. What have I got to show for it? You know, what do people think of me? What do I think of myself? You know, it was a big self-evaluation. I was really inspired. I think I've talked to you about this, but, you know, one of my favorite albums of all time is Tunnel of Love by Bruce Springsteen. And I know even Springsteen purists aren't as big a fans of that one as I am, but I always admired it because it's so truthful.
Right.
I mean, everything that's going on with his life.
Truthful in a difficult situation.
Yeah, his marriage is dissolving and all that, and he just lays it out there. And even I read an interview recently where, you know, that first song, he's talking about being a rich man in a poor man's shirt, and Steve Van Zandt, like, saying, like, I wanted to punch him in the mouth. Like, no one wants to hear about you being a rich man. Yeah. You know, and I loved that because I knew, you know, that's a real dilemma for this guy. I'm so interested that he would be that honest with me. And I wanted that record of Midlife to be that honest as I could be. That was my goal. Like, it's going to be a portrait of where I am right now, and it's going to be honest. And is you know, I'm not going to try and romanticize it too much.
Yeah, I mean, you had reached the point where you were completely using your craft to work through issues that you had. And
yeah,
and if it hadn't come out, if it hadn't been recorded, do you think just the act of writing those songs would have served its purpose?
I don't know. I mean, they definitely served a purpose. And it was, you know, it was a great time. It was a powerful time for me because it was during that time where I was allowed not to work for a little while and work solely on music.
Well, some of them were. But you know, even before we talked about making a record, I think you had already written Bring Me Some Water.
Yeah, there's some I had worked on, but it was a real challenge because it's sort of like, you know, put up or shut up, you know? I mean, one of the things that we humans do is we always have excuses for why we haven't achieved the things we want to do, you know? If I didn't have to work, I'd go to the gym every day. Well, now someone said you don't have to work. Are you going to really go to the gym every day? You know, it's sort of like that.
Right.
So I got to... I really felt like I need to put up or shut up. Like, this is it. Like, this is my shot. This is my moment to actually do something. And even if this is it, if all I do is make this record and then have to go, you know, become a whatever, a assistant chef somewhere, like, I want to make this as honest. I want to capture this picture, and you know, I'm not going to flinch from it. And you can, looking back, at least I'll be able to say, well, this is where I was then.
You were definitely very honest on a lot of the songs. Stop Ticking is one that I wanted to talk about.
Yeah, that's one I mentioned earlier about my parents. Yeah, you know, my parents are old, and that was one I really labored over, because I wanted to tell their story. I wanted it to be, sort of a memorial, even though they're not dead, but they're getting very old.
Right.
And I was worried about them, and I wanted to capture their story. And in so doing it, I revealed my story. I think that's the most telling story about me, a most telling song about me. You know, I talk about my broken hearts and all that, but if you really want to know about me, you listen to that song, you'll have a pretty good idea.
I'd walk for miles, cry or smile, for my mama and daddy.
Sing this oratory, a love story for the glory of the two for me. God made me, but he did it through them. And when I opened my eyes, I cried. The only reason I'm alive is because they survived some trying times before me. Didn't know it at the time, but they climbed the mountain for me. A lifetime of sacrifice and giving, churning, yearning, earning a living. Now every minute that I'm with them is like Thanksgiving. Yeah, when I'm with them, it's like Thanksgiving. I wanna tell the clock, stop ticking. I don't wanna lose you. I don't wanna lose you. I don't wanna lose you. But I'm going to. Mom was a German Jewish immigrant whose own government had the distinction of planning her extinction.
All you
she fled in 38, came to the States. A resident alien acclimating in the eighth grade. Many relations disappeared or died. Both the grandparents committed suicide. Too dignified to hide from a Nazis who couldn't stop me. I'm here today cause that brave woman begot me. My dad was a lad back in the Depression with few possessions. Your best with less is life lesson. Stretching every penny, using each and every scrap.
Yeah,
busting his back, picking tobacco, bitching hay in a stack. Back then they did everything by hand. I was raised in the same place, he became a man. And his sweat ran out of land where I'm standing. Understand nothing's more important than family. And when I'm with him, it's like Thanksgiving. Yeah, when I'm with him, it's like Thanksgiving. I wanna tell the clock, stop. I don't wanna lose you. I don't wanna lose you. I don't wanna lose you. But I'm going to. Did service to this nation, got college education, dedication and determination, built a reputation, earned respect and admiration from the rest of the community. They helped any and many more than me, that's just the tip of the list. They've accomplished more than this, not the least of which are raising five kids, of which I'm number four, the one before the encore. Lord, they gave me a life and they showed me what it's for. Furthermore, the current score is 8 grandchildren. Someday I may make it 9 or 10, God willing. Any child of mine, I'll remind from time to time that they're standing in a long, proud line. And when I'm with them, it's like Thanksgiving. When I'm with them, it's like Thanksgiving. I wanna tell the clock to stop ticking. I don't wanna lose you. I don't wanna lose you.
What's kind of funny is that you rap on the song. You know, being in Nashville all those years brought out the hip hop influence in your music more than being in New York did.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, I was listening to it in New York, but I wasn't doing it. And I don't know. I mean, some of it may have been like in response to like being in Nashville. There's just so many, I mean, really phenomenal singers. It's just like, I can't do that. I'm going to just try and get my words down. So, but that was some of it. But also some of it is the way the song, there's too much story. There's too much story to spread it out and sing it. It's very detailed, and there's a lot I wanted to say. And, you know, if I had made it, you know, I could have made a whole record about that song, or I could have made one song with a lot of words. Whenever I play it out, I always say, like, man, if I just get paid by the word, it would have been good.
You did some interesting stuff with rap on that record. I also wanted to talk about Unring the Bell.
Yeah.
Which is a song where you rap and you have singing going on at the same time.
Yeah, you know, that one, you know, Unring the Bell, the idea of it, obviously, is that, you know, what's done is done, and you can't undo the past, you can't change things that have happened. And so I'm singing this song, and alone just saying that, you know, what's done is done, we can't go on pretending it never happened. But it seemed kind of fluffier a little bit just like that. So then I thought, you know, if I'm going to do this as honest as I am, I'm going to talk about the things that I'm ashamed of. And so I sort of, behind it, I sort of wrapped some letters sort of things to some people or that things that I'm not proud of. And together with that idea of like, that I'm sorry, but I can't change it. That's how the song became powerful to me.
Change, I know.
everlasting. I'm sort of worried, you know, there's lines that I purposely kind of ducked down a little bit because I really, you know, if someone has to read that rap and knows every word, it's really like, oh, Fred, really? Yeah, I did that.
Do you ever get any feedback from people with songs like that, that you know, that you're singing about, and they hear it and they get in touch with you?
You know, no, I can't think. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't think anyone responded personally to that song. I mean, I don't know. It's funny. I think the people that I talked to in that song, you know, I feel so bad about it that I really don't have much of a relationship with them anymore.
Or even a song like Stop Ticking, or other songs that reference your family, like Stranger, you know, Stop in Ticking, the Family.
Like my parents, like when I first started playing it, I did some shows up in New England, and they were like, if they were there, they're like, please don't play that song. Because they feel they're very private and self-conscious. But I had to explain to them that it was my song, not theirs, and I'm going to do it, you know.
Have you gotten around to watching, there's a documentary called Beauty is Embarrassing?
No, I've never even heard of it.
It's by this guy. It's about this guy, Wayne White, who was the, among other things, he was the art director for Pee Wee's Playhouse.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot of stuff in there about his relationship with his parents, particularly his father and how when he was a kid, his dad was like this golden god that was sort of unapproachable. And now his dad comes to his appearances and cries.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, you know, like I said, I'm really grateful that my parents have heard that song. I think it's very meaningful to them. I found a way to say it to them. Anyways, you know, I don't know. You know, I'm a huge Philip Roth fan. I don't know whether you are or not. But he has a book, I think it's called The Ghostwriter, which, you know, basically the premise is about if you're going to be an artist, really want to be an artist, like, it means alienating yourself from everyone and being willing to tell the truth to your family, even though it's going to piss people off, you know? So I think that was a line I was willing to, particularly in those earlier records when I was, you know, the 20-year-old who wanted to get the hell out of town, I was very happy to tell everyone, you know, what sucked. You know? Then as I got a little older, I got to see the virtue in a lot of those things.
It's true. As we get older and we have families of our own, we have to be a little more judicious about you know, which truths we tell.
I know, because I know when Oscar's 18, he's going to talk about what a dick I am. I hope, you know, that he'll outgrow it.
And it's nice to believe in stuff like what Roth says, but if you're a father, and if you're a husband, or if you're a mother and a wife, then you can't just wholeheartedly dedicate yourself to your art. You have to live in the world too.
Yeah, I think so, and that's probably why, you know. But when you're 20,
right,
you can do it,
right. Yeah. Even a guy, my buddy Matt Wardlaw and I interviewed Bruce Hornsby a little while ago, and he talked about feeling. This was something that really struck a chord with me. I wanted to kind of grab him by the shirt and say I got it. But he talked about when you're creating, you feel guilty because you're not with your family, and when you're with your family, you feel guilty because you're not creating.
Yeah, that's totally true. I mean, I constantly had that dilemma because I want to work all the time.
Yeah. Because you love your job.
Even like after my first child was born, like I took some time off. Because, you know, it's our first baby. No one knows what the fuck they're doing when you have a baby. You're trying to, you know, there's no, and I want to be there to help as much as I can. And I'm very, very involved. You know, I'm not one of those guys that just walks around the house. I'm really involved on every, all the day-to-day stuff around here. But that first, so I took like, I don't know, 3 weeks or maybe even a month. And I went crazy. I was climbing. I mean, I just could. I mean, it's horrible to say we've got this beautiful baby, but I couldn't wait to get back to work. And I did. I finally just had to, you know, even though I wasn't supposed to start working, I was like, I got to go and go into the studio. And I just, Yeah, I need. I feel bad if I take a long weekend and go somewhere. I'm feeling like, you know, I got so much I want to do and so much I haven't done, and this is waiting, and not like just about like, you know, the things on your to-do list, but like, I want to. It's not because there's stuff to do; it's because I want to do it.
Right.
You know. So it's crazy. So then you do that, and then just like Hornsby said, then you're, you know, at the studio work until 1 o'clock, and you miss dinner with your family. Tucking your kids in and you feel like a heel. I'm in a good spot today. Today I'm in a good spot. You know, I recently sent you that song that I wrote with Matthew Pearman Jones.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Which was great. I loved it. And it was, you know, and that was like me being as, you know, as arty as I want to be, you know, and I'm lucky that I have some artists that I write with that'll go there with me. So I sort of feel like, given the opportunity, like I'm ready to go there, you know. And I write those songs, and then other times, you know, like I said, the muse is he always shows up. He always shows up. Like, I don't know, it's crazy, but he always shows up. I'm not I don't go through periods of writer's block. You know, it's just a matter along how hard you want to work for him to show up. You know, I mean, I may have to bang around, you know, the better part of a day before he shows up. But eventually he shows up, or she shows up.
That's a great way of looking at it. I don't know what else we can add to that. That's pretty perfect. Until I can get somebody to pay you to write a book about how to... get around.
It, you know, it I mean, I remember seeing listening to Dorothy Allison talk, and she was saying how she needs to write, she needs to have a level of necessary boredom that, like,
in order to create, you mean?
Yeah, to create. So, like, if, you know, she, like, writing is the last thing she can do, and if she's like, if she's at her house and wants to write, and like, if she has, you know, if she has to clip her nails, she has to do that before she can write. Like, if there's absolutely nothing else to do but write, then it happens. And some, you know, occasionally there's those days where it's like, you just got to stay there and stay at it and look at it and noodle around and play. And eventually it shows up, but you got to really put your time in.
That'll do it for this episode of the show. I hope you've enjoyed hearing Fred's insights into the craft, as well as a few of his songs. You can learn and hear more at his website, fredwilhelm.com. Please join me in a few weeks for our next installment of A Fine Mess, which will find me speaking with producer, singer-songwriter, and recording artist Dean Jones about his new album, When the World Was New.